The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, the Edward Snowden story from Inside the Guardian, was recorded at King's Place, London in March 2015 and was chaired by Mark Lawson.
Good evening. Welcome to the question and answer session, which is being streamed. We have microphones out there and upstairs as well. And so I'll ask a few questions here and then we'll just open it up to all of you. You've just seen Laura Poitras's film. And with us on stage, we have Alan Rusbridger, editor-in-chief of The Guardian, commonly described as mild-mannered, as people point out, but now also described as outgoing because he leaves in July to go on to... to go on to other things. Janine Gibson, editor-in-chief of Guardian.com, is one of the declared candidates who hopes to replace him in July. There may be other undeclared candidates on the platform or in the room. Who knows? But she has declared. Stuart Miller, who hasn't, is head of news. And Ewan McCaskill, you will recognize, having just watched him on screen. Alan Rusbridger, in another film you may have seen, The Fifth Estate, was played by Peter Capaldi. And Oliver Stone is now making the fictional, or at least dramatic, version of this story. And Janine, you are being played by?
I think I'm being played by Jodie Richardson, which is, as you can already tell, like looking in a mirror.
And Ewan, which of the great Scottish actors have they got to play you?
He hasn't got the Glasgow accent right, but it's Tom Wilkinson.
Wow, well that's, yeah. And Stuart, you're Sean Connery? No?
He was unavailable for tax purposes. So, yeah.
So who's playing you?
I'm not sure, but it might be somebody Welsh.
So oh, right. Yeah. Oh, we can probably guess one of those Welsh... actors. So the film goes up to a certain point, and obviously I think anyone watching it wonders what happened next to some degree. So first of all, Ewan, did you get an encrypted Christmas card from Mr. Snowden this year?
Well, it's funny enough, I do still speak to him, and I speak to him on encrypted chat. We've got a sort of complex system of messaging, but it works pretty well. And he spends, although life in Russia you would think it would be pretty severe, and he doesn't really want to be there. And his life's not that different. When he was in the States, he lived a sort of virtual existence, online, talking to friends, and he does much the same. He sits up till early hours of the morning, and you're talking to campaigners and sympathizers, and he watches everything. He knows about Rifkin, standing down, and the IPT report, and you're probably watching this as well.
I say, could be watching now, yeah. And it appeared on the film that it would be quite easy to work out where he is in Moscow, but is it?
Myself and Alan went to Moscow last summer, and we met him in the hotel, and there was elaborate procedures for where we would meet him, and it was in doubt until the last half hour. But we never discovered where he came from or where he went to after he left.
And the film is, it has a thriller element, but also it's biographically very strong because of the fascination of this character and why he did what he did. And you've also met Julian Assange, who's in the same area. I'm just interested because it's part of your job to assess people. And what did you make of him?
Well, I think he's very different from Julian Assange. He's very measured. We had this question when we went there. We knew we would have about 6.5, 7 hours with him, and you and I had a discussion to begin with whether it would be better to have an hour of filming and 5 hours of discussion, or whether it would be better to film him for 5 hours and have an hour of sort of off-the-record chat at the end. And we went for the 5 hours of filming, which is quite an that would be quite an ordeal for anybody, I think, to speak for 5 hours, knowing that it was all going to be filmed and used. And he's just got this extraordinary control and intellect and ability to speak in sentences as though he's thought about. And I don't think there was anything that we asked him that he couldn't answer in almost perfectly formed sentences. And so he's a very different character from Assange, who could be brilliant, and could be unbrilliant.
And for the fascination of that 8-day deposition, as Alan says, where he's so fluent. Now, did you, when you were working on this story here, did you have access to that?
No, we didn't. And in fact, the first time that we were, Janine and I were in New York, and until about 2 hours before Snowden was revealed to the world, we didn't know his name, we didn't know what he looked like, we didn't know what he sounded like, because we had to keep it all so under wraps. So there was, when we saw the video that the world saw on that Sunday afternoon, there was a massive relief because, he was so, as Alan says, very eloquent, spoke so fluidly, measured, not a sort of wide-eyed, staring ideologue, and quite hot. So that was that helps. And I think the really striking thing for me when I saw the film was that, the interview wasn't just a sort of, Snowden at his best TV delivery. That's just how he talks. All his sentences are delivered like that, and there's just a sort of control and an understanding of the subject, which is just amazing.
One of my favourite moments of yours in the film, I think the favourite, was where he puts the bag over his head in order to avoid visual capture by his laptop, and there's a little cutaway to you, and you have that moment that all journalists have sometimes with their sources thinking, is this guy actually mad, and can we trust him? But you were thinking that, weren't you, at that point?
I was. when Snowden was 29 when I saw him in Hong Kong, but as you can see from the screen, he looks about 21. And he said that he'd worked for the NSA in America, he'd worked for the CIA in Geneva, he said he'd worked for the NSA in Japan, Hawaii, and I found this sort of hard to believe, sort of looking at him. And then he threw into the conversation, and this is when I really panicked, that he'd trained with the Iraqi, he wanted to go to Iraq, so he applied and joined the army and started training with the special forces. And when he was training, he broke both his legs. And at this point, I thought, this guy is complete Walter Mitty. So it was against this background, trying to establish if he was real or not. He starts. He did a trick that I've told Alan and others about. When he would leave his hotel room, which wasn't very often, he'd put a glass of water behind the door with a piece of a paper napkin with soya sauce on it. So if someone came in when he was out, the water would spill, and you couldn't undo the soya mark. So all these things were going on. So when he reached the point where he pulls the red mantle over his head, well, that just sort of... Because at the time, I didn't understand why he was doing it. And later, I think I asked him why he was doing it, and he said it was possible there was a camera hidden in the room, and they would have seen him putting his password into... his computer, or somebody could be filming from outside the window, or apparently just sort of listening to the chatter, you could pick up the keys. So,
and all the broken legs and everything, does that, as it were, stand up?
It does, yeah, that's the astonishing thing. Right. He did do all these things, right. Yeah.
And the thing that journalism students will obviously study for a long time is the ethical question, which is that amazing moment where he says, it's my intention, you pin a target to my back, you nail me to a cross, I know what's going to happen and I don't care. Mm. Now, this is really for the editors around the table. Do you still have to worry ethically, even if someone has said, I don't care what's going to happen to me? Alan?
Janine, you answer that first.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the strange thing about our relationship with the source was it was necessarily remote. You know, we saw the material because Glenn brought it to New York and showed us the sort of the sample material, if you like, which was the presentation that was the Prism story and a few other documents. And it was on that basis that we sent Glenn and Ewan and Laura to Hong Kong. But we never, as Stuart said, we didn't know who the source was. You know, at the point where we put them on a plane, we knew we wouldn't be able to talk to them, that every communication would have to be very coded or encrypted, and that you were basically sending them to verify the source, that the material was either the biggest security, national security leak in a generation, if ever, or a massive hoax that would make the Hitler diaries sort of slightly pale. And so you're putting an awful lot of faith in Ewan McCaskill at that point. Thank God he was there. And really, the same was true of our relationship to the source. You know, for all the time that we were publishing the stories and analysing the material and, you know, working with the lawyers and talking to the government, we were relying entirely on Ewan and Glenn to be talking to the source. And my duty of care to the source, I thought, came via them. So I was hearing, often via very convoluted encrypted chat. I mean, it looks quite good on the screen. It looks really fast. And, oh, you say something and they type back and you're having a conversation. It's not like that at all. The connection drops. Glenn talks on chat in what can only be described as a fiery bark of monosyllabic something.
Same as real life.
Yeah, well, sort of real life, yeah. Apart from when he's got the dogs. But you don't sort of... So you're really, you know, it came back to us as he doesn't really want us to know what his plans are. He doesn't want us to feel responsible for him. He wants us to focus... I think there's a bit in the film where he talks about not wanting to make the decision about what to publish, that he has a sort of slightly idealised version of the media's role. And it makes you want to do the right thing by him and make good decisions. But what he didn't seem to want us to do was to be concerned about him, that he was always going to go public, that was always going to be the thing. And that, so it sort of, you know, you did all of that, really, didn't you, with him?
Did you worry about it? Yeah.
You felt very fatherly towards him.
I did. I've got three sons, so they were roughly Snowden's age, so I did feel that. I felt for his father. I thought, if that was me, I wouldn't like one of my own kids to be in that predicament, because we all thought he was going to jail for life, that was the likeliest outcome. The one regret I have about Hong Kong is, for a while afterwards, I thought we didn't look after him well enough, and I discussed with both Janine and Alan at the time before he went into hiding, what can we do for him? And we discussed paying his hotel bills, maybe legal bills. And then in Hong Kong, we thought he was going to fight extradition in Hong Kong. And I left Hong Kong and thought, that's it. And when WikiLeaks organized his flight to Latin America via Moscow, I thought at the time that WikiLeaks had made a major blunder. And it was a huge mistake. But now... that sense of guilt is gone, because by accident or design, he's ended up in the one place in the world where he's safe. If he'd ended up in Latin America, there'd have been a CIA hit squad in there and snatched him, or there'd have been pressure, diplomatic or economic pressure on Venezuela or Ecuador. The Chinese didn't want him. They wouldn't have allowed him over the border from Hong Kong into China. So the one place in the world, by default, he's ended up where he's safe.
I think the thing about Snowden was, all you can do with a source is be transparent and to sort of say, okay, by talking to us, here are the things that might happen and here are the things we might be able to do to protect you, but in this world there's not an awful lot, and it's very rare you would ever get a source coming in who knows more about encryption, who knows more about the organisation that they're up against, and who is better prepared than any journalist could ever be. And you know, you saw Glenn in the film saying to him, you know, you could go to prison for this. It's practically the first question Ewan asked him as well. And it was very clear from the start that that's what he was going to do, because he knew how it would unfold from there.
Adam, on that question, because I think Glenn was surprised, there was a Five Live interview, I don't know anyone here heard that, when his book came out, where I think he was surprised. The entire line of questioning from both the interviewer and people phoning up was, you have got the glory and this guy has lost his life. In effect, I mean, I think they said he was living in a dingy attic in Moscow. In fact, it looks rather pleasant on the film. But did you, it is something that you, and the others have all answered, but it's something you have to worry about.
Yeah, I think always with sources, you know, why are they doing it? How much have they thought through? What are the consequences going to be? Are they good people, bad people? I mean, most sources are operating out of quite questionable motives. but I think, I mean, it was Janine's decision to send Ewan, and I mean, you can tell from Ewan's demeanor what the kind of guy he is. When all this was happening in America, we were giving a lot of TV interviews, and the only way I could describe him in shorthand was to refer to him as Scottish Presbyterian, which he slightly objects to, because it's a long time since you've thought of yourself as a Scottish Presbyterian. But he's you know, one of the most straight, unimpressible, experienced all-round reporters on The Guardian. So having him as your proxy in the room taking these decisions was incredibly important. I think if we hadn't had Ewan in the room, no disrespect to Glenn or Laura, but we didn't really know them so well, it might have been very different.
And before we open it up, I think this is one for you, Ewan, and your role as defence and intelligence correspondent. I think most people who watch the film, they're astonished by the extent to which the American government and the British government go on defending these practices. So what, because it seems indefensible to a lot of people, but how do they justify it?
Well, you've all heard the argument. What's astonishing is I thought the NSA and GCHQ would be on the defensive. But what's happened over the last 6 months is that the are actually asking for more powers. And the argument is, if the more they know, they'll be better able to stop another attack, and or B, once an attack takes place, they'll be able to find the person faster. I think it's totally wrong-headed. I'm not anti-intelligence. I'm glad they're there. We need an intelligence service for tracking down terrorists or paedophiles or organised crime. And you need to keep some people under surveillance. The objection is to, and the GCHQ hate this word, but the objection is to mass surveillance. And there, all the examples we've had from 9/11, Boston Massacre, Charlie Hebdo, Jihad John, all these people were known to the security services. They could have had them under traditional surveillance. Mass surveillance didn't contribute one iota to any of those cases. So the onus is on... All Snowden wanted was a debate, and that's what the motive of The Guardian was. So we don't sort of walk into a world where people are watched and the internet has given them these great tools. So all he wanted was that debate. So the onus, as far as I'm concerned, is for GCHQ and NSA to explain the benefits of what they call bulk data collection.
And that, just before we find out what the audience thought, that scene where they smash the disc in the basement of The Guardian, do you keep a fragment of it as President Obama is supposed to have a fragment of the helicopter from Obama? Brian Williams had another bit as well, he claims.
We've got a whole cardboard box of fragments, like pieces of the cross. and the V&A has got one. The British Museum toyed with the idea of having one, but we should probably sell them off as part of the Guardian membership scene. We could. I've changed my view about them, because to begin with, I remember the mayor of Leipzig coming to see me. There was this extraordinary reaction. I mean, the reaction in the UK was a bit muted, but there was an extraordinary reaction in America and in Europe, and especially in Germany, for reasons that I think we can all imagine, that the Germans take this very seriously as part of their recent past. So when the mayor of Leipzig came in and asked to see the smashed up hard disk, he immediately thought of burning books. He thought this was a terrible sort of iconic symbol. And I thought of it that way for some time, but actually as time's gone, I see it as a rather sort of optimistic thing, that actually although they came into this building and supervised our destruction of it, it had no effect whatsoever. As I said to the cabinet secretary at the time when he said this is what he wanted to do, I said, but it's already in America. You know, what do you think you're going to achieve? Glenn's got a copy in Rio. I can see the symbolism, but what's it going to achieve? And actually, so to my mind, it now symbolizes the impossibility of repressive governments suppressing the flow of information. So actually, I think it's rather an optimistic icon now.
But were they going for the other symbolic power? I mean, was it a warning to others? The government?
I've discussed it with people in government since and said, with hindsight, what did you think you were hoping to achieve? And they say, well, with hindsight, it was a pointless thing to do. So I think they now realise it wasn't the smartest thing in the world to have done, partly because it just made them look so bad. what a terrible image of Britain as a cradle of free speech. I assume what was going on was that there were, COBRA meetings or whatever the equivalent of for the intelligence services, and they were. I think there must have been some hawks who really wanted to come up and just close down the Guardian and string me up or send me to the Tower or whatever, and that this somehow bought them off. It sort of made life, and it did make life harder because we all had to decamp to America and the communications were hard. Everything about this story was very hard, logistically, ethically, legally.
No, I was just going to say, it didn't actually change the reality of publishing one jot. I think what it revealed, remember that conversation, but I can remember the conversation where you were saying to them, but it's already in America. I can also remember a subsequent conversation where we were talking about publishing a story in partnership with the New York Times, because we were sort of forced into partnership with the New York Times and were very grateful for their support once they were housing the documents, where they said to us, do you have to publish it at the same time? And we said, well, yes. And they said, well, what if you let them publish it first, just by a bit? At which point you sort of thought, actually, the only thing the UK establishment is interested in is slightly offshoring the problem. If they can go, well, it wasn't on our watch. And then somebody actually said, if it's on the New York Times website, can you read that here? This is the fundamental sort of dichotomy of the story, is that we're reading all these documents that show this enormous technological capacity, this sort of fearsome, sinister force that can take everything you do online, and at the same time you've got somebody on the end of the phone going, can you get that website here? Can you send me a link?
And we'll probably find out from the audience, but it's quite hard to watch the film without becoming paranoid, so... Do you do all that stuff every time you leave a room? You put a glass of water with soy sauce.
I put the thing on my head.
Yeah, the thing over your head.
Yeah, on Skype.
And you use a mobile phone once.
Yeah, it did make us very paranoid. The night we published the Verizon story, I had to we published the story, and then I had to leave and come back to the office. And then the hour and a half I was out of the office, our entire block in Broadway in Soho had been dug up, and they were laying new cables.
We were just standing there in the office looking out the window.
I'm sure it was a coincidence.
Oh, which is exactly what Snowden says in the film.
Yeah.
That they're digging up.
No, it was extraordinary. No, workmen have never moved so fast. It was literally an hour and a half. And, it just makes you completely paranoid. We would get cabs, and the cab driver would say things like, you'd say, how much is that? And he says, how much do you usually pay?
That really happened.
Okay.
Very early on. We got in the cab. We'd been really educated to only have face-to-face conversations. That are really the only safe way to communicate was face-to-face. So I'd been talking to Glenn on crypto thing all night. in Hong Kong. And we got in the cabin morning, we were sharing a cabin to the office, and I was going around and he said, this and this and this happened, this happened. And then the guy turned around and said, and how much do you usually pay for this fare?
Which way is the Brooklyn Bridge?
Yeah. Which way do you normally go? Oh, we've fallen for the oldest one in the book already. Tell them about when you got pulled off the plane.
So we went, Janine and I went to Rio after after Glenn, Ewan came back to London, Glenn came back to Rio, and we, obviously Glenn couldn't come into the US with those laptops, so we went to meet him, and there was a very funny conversation with the Guardian's lawyers before we went, where Janine and I said, we're really worried about getting back into the US, and they said, it's getting out of the US you should be worrying about. And but then we went to Rio, and as we were there for sort of 3 or 4 days, and as we were getting back on the plane back to New York, we were walking down the gate, and I was sort of taken aside into the extra security measures. Janine doesn't know what happened next because she was gone. She was never to be seen again.
Are you travelling with him? I don't know.
But it was, you know, and then they searched my bags and there was lots of stuff. And, you know, luckily it was all on Janine, so it was fine. Yeah. So, make you very paranoid.
I thought, I've got to get out of here. I've got the stuff. I've got to get out of here. And I'm sitting there waiting for Stuart, who's disappeared into the sort of cordoned off corridor that you only see in E.T. I'm thinking, he's never coming back, he's gone for good. I've got to go anyway. What can I do at this point? I thought, I know, I'll compose a really impassioned tweet. Because we had been publishing at this point, saying that the deputy editor of Guardian US has been detained at Rio Airport. Once we've left the runway is when I'll do that. I thought that would probably see you right. You'd be fine. You'd be fine.
Okay, we've got some microphones downstairs and upstairs. I can see upstairs, so we'll start down here. Who would like to start? Yes, a hand has gone up in the middle. A black-clad hand, I think, yeah. So if we go on there, and then so we can do as many as possible. If anyone wants to call for the other microphone, we can do that. Thanks.
Hi. Great evening so far. My question is about the release of this. I heard it was clearly not on public, not on general release. It's not in all the cinemas. It's not easy to find. Is it true that there have been heavy restrictions on getting this out? And the TV version of it, how edited was it?
Well, the TV version is available for 2 more days on 4 on demand, and then it will go, after that, it will go, will it be permanently or not on 4AD?
I don't think so. I think it's just there for 7 days.
Yeah, so it's there for 2 more days there, so you can get that. And is that different, does anyone know, the TV version? Yeah.
Thank God.
You've got anyone from BritDoc in there? Are you from BritDoc?
I'm Duke from BritDoc. So, yeah, it is on 4AD for 2 more days, and will be on iTunes in late April. It's not a different version. The version on 4D is the same as the theatrical one.
Were there problems with the release? Was it a limited release?
It wasn't so limited for a documentary. No, it's doing quite well, and it's still in the ICA cinema in London.
Okay, and yes, if we could get the... We're just bringing down... I'm busy with the streaming, yeah, if you can wait till you get the microphone. Thanks.
Alan, what sort of, we know the kind of things that happened after this story was published. Before it was published, what sort of pressure was The Guardian under? Were you getting calls from government, ministers? What sort of pressure did you face? And did you succumb to any of that pressure at all by not publishing any particular part of the story? And secondly, I wondered, you speak to him quite regularly, to Edward Snowden. What's life like for him in Moscow? I mean, what does he plan to do after this? Does he go to work? Does he go to the gym? What does he do?
in terms of pre-publication, we because we'd worked with the New York Times over the WikiLeaks documents, we had sort of got into a frame of mind where we were definitely going to go to the government in advance, and I think that was completely right. I think that's less in the British mind than it is in the American mind, for an obvious reason, which is to do with the law. So in America, it is virtually impossible, since the Pentagon Papers case, 1972, for the American government to seek any kind of injunction, whereas in Britain, it's more or less guaranteed that they will try and stop you. So that makes it harder as a British journalist to interact with the government. But then, nevertheless, this material was so sensitive that we were always going to go to them. So we began publishing in America, and it began with Janine talking to every agency and acronym in the American Defense Department.
I had a... Well, first, we put the story to them, just the Verizon court order, the one you saw, and Dan Roberts from our DC office rang up and said, heads up, they've just rung the office asking who runs this operation and where are you? So you can imagine they were Googling. And then I got a call saying, are you available for a call, you know, with the NSC representative from the White House? And actually, when the call came through, it was a sort of five-party, at least five-party conference call. And it was basically the sort of deputy director of the NSA, deputy director of the CIA, deputy director of the FBI, deputy director of the... Yeah, it was just kind of... it was like the Joint Chiefs had assembled.
They're all called Bob.
They're all called Bob. And they started off calling us you folks and lots of sort of charming things. We just wanted to check in with you folks and see what you're thinking about doing. And it ended up with some really quite haughty exchanges about the nature of journalism and who decides what should be published or who has the right understanding of national security to make a decision about where to publish a document. And I don't know, there was a lot of them, and then there was us, and we didn't even have a proper speakerphone, so that was slightly problematic. But I think they thought that we would do what most of the American press does, which is sort of, you know, go in for a nice chat in the Roosevelt Room and have a, you know, sort of civilized four-day conversation about it, and then go talk to some other publishers, and of course we were saying, well, no, we're going to publish it in about 5 hours.
The form on this is the New York Times in 2005 when they did the warrantless wiretapping story, or rather didn't do the warrantless wiretapping story. They sat on that for a year. So I think the American government felt confident that by talking to you, they might be able to talk you out of it. In Britain, the pressure was pretty intense, and the pressure was reinforced by the knowledge, on my assumption, that at some point they would go for an injunction, as they eventually said they would if we didn't smash up the discs. And that led to one compromise in order to get the first story out. The one thing they were terribly keen on was that we didn't mention the names of the telephone companies that were involved. That was the thing they were most alarmed by, and we didn't. Because I thought, if that's the price we have to pay in order to get this story out, we won't. I mean, the names have since come out in the German press, but we didn't succumb in terms of not publishing. But that was the one thing. Was it right or not? I think I marginally regret not doing it. But if we hadn't agreed to do it, they might have gone for the injunction with the consequence that we wouldn't have been able to publish at all.
I was going to say, you have to assume as editors that if they go for an injunction, they will get it. I mean, there's no...
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes people have a go at me and say, oh, you know, you were craven in smashing up the discs. I mean, all that probably would have happened was that either the police would have been around here or lawyers... with an injunction that, as far as we know, would have covered The Guardian everywhere. So it would have covered Janine in New York. It would have covered Glenn. Glenn would have ignored that. He would have gone on publishing. The Washington Post would have gone on publishing, and we would have been caught in a 2-year legal battle, costing us millions of pounds, unable to publish. So I couldn't think what principle would be involved in fighting a brave legal fight that you might be destined to lose and not publish when you could just smash up the discs and go on publishing in America.
There's another point as well about smashing up the discs, which is which was a very serious problem at the time, which you can't risk seizure of the disc. So you absolutely can't risk them coming in and seizing either hardware or discs that we've been using, or that any of our reporters or staff or our source have been moving across borders, because that's the main crime that they can charge people with, is moving material around. And you just can't be sure what metadata is contained within the equipment itself. Also, at that point, People didn't know what Snowden had taken. So we've talked about duty of care to the source. One of the main things we could do for our source was not expose him to further criticism over what he had leaked. And, you know, he trusted Ewan with a much larger number of documents from the GCHQ wiki than he had given, certainly at that stage, to Glenn and Laura. The material that had gone out in the first tranche was very carefully sorted. He'd really pre-sifted to make sure he was giving documents that related to the stories regarding mass surveillance. Whereas the stuff that he gave to Ewan, he gave because he trusted Ewan and consequently The Guardian to make good decisions about what to publish in the national interest, to hit that balance between not damaging or revealing secrets, but telling the story. And what we didn't want was people coming in and being able to launch a greater case either against him or against our journalists from what they could find out from the desk.
But also on the national interest, there's that very significant moment, I think, in the film where he says, it's that exchange where he says, Britain is leading the field in this stuff at GCHQ, which does clearly redefine the... I mean, it clearly gives a national interest defence here, doesn't it?
I was really surprised by it. Because Glenn and Laura are Americans, they were mainly interested in the NSA. And it was towards the end of an interview that lasted a couple of hours, and I just threw in the question... You know, what about the UK? What about GCHQ? And Snowden became really animated and came out with that phrase saying GCHQ are worse than the NSA, which I was really surprised by. And asked him what evidence he had for that. And he says, come back tomorrow and I'll give you some. So I thought he'd give me maybe two documents. And I think, as you saw there, he gave me 60,000.
And Ewan, just quickly, the gentleman's other question about, so what, give us a snapshot of the life of Snowden in Moscow.
A lot of nonsense has been written about Snowden's life in Russia, that he's depressed, he's an alcoholic, he doesn't drink.
Hasn't seen daylight for 2 years.
For 2 years. His girlfriend's left him. Well, none of it's true. As you saw there, Lindsay Mills is in Moscow. She sometimes goes back to the States, but she goes to see him in Moscow as well. And the Citizen Four, that was the first time that it was revealed that she was in the States. If you'll just indulge me for a minute, I spoke to Snowden just recently. And I told him I was coming to this event and asked him if he wanted to send a message. It's only two paragraphs, and I'm crap at reading things out, but I'll read it anyway. The people coming to this event are Guardian readers, so you could address it to Guardian readers. But what he's done is, it sounds like a press release for The Guardian.
We're quite happy for you to read it. It's all ones and zeros.
I've decrypted it. Free societies depend on an adversarial press, one that understands its core mission is to expose abuses of authority. Without the remarkable work of brave and talented journalists, including those at The Guardian, we would today still be ignorant of the reality of mass surveillance and the threat it poses to our democracies. Citizen Four is a film about the Fourth Estate, and I hope we never forget that whether you're a newsreader or a newsmaker, every free society is founded on the willingness of its citizens to speak truth to power, even in the face of great risks.
Do you want that for your editorship bit? It'd be quite useful. You could just, use that. We'll just take more questions in a minute. But just one thing that struck me, Janine, was in the film, how bad, it was the general, wasn't it, the second person appearing before the Senate. What a bad liar he was. He does every possible tell for lying, if you've read. It's astonishing. He daren't look them in the eye, and then he tries to cover up his face. I was surprised by quite how nervous he was. I suppose they didn't want to be dragged into the light, do they? And
the NSA had survived with an extraordinary little scrutiny for a very long time. they weren't talked about, and when they were talked about, they were talked about in wholly reverent terms. So extreme was the reverence for the NSA, especially after 9/11, which you can understand, that a feature was done in Wired magazine, looking around their new offices, which are roughly the size of a state. They're massive, massive complex, and you can see these pictures, they're still online. And it showed the control room, the information control room that they have, which has been built to replicate the control room of the Starship Enterprise. That isn't a joke. He had the set designers in. He had the set designers in from Hollywood, and he said, "Build me the information dominance room. It's going to look like the Starship Enterprise, and I will have the captain's chair in the middle of it." And so that when the senators and the congressmen and everybody comes around to talk about funding, I'll say, "Would you like to sit in the captain's chair in the information dominance room?" And it'll be like being on the Starship Enterprise. And I mean, we're all laughing because we're a bit British, but that works. You know, that works. They just, how much was their funding? Can you remember how much that budget was?
It's something extraordinary. I know it's, no, I've forgotten. I know it's, the defence budget is 50 billion, isn't it? And they take, the intelligence budget is 50 billion. And they take, I think, 40 billion of that.
Mostly for the Starship Enterprise.
Mostly for the Starship Enterprise, yeah.
Wow. We'll take some all down from here. I just, because our eye line is out there, could I just see how many people there are upstairs who'd like to ask a question? You don't have to, but if it's just I'm worried about leaving you out. If you, we're going to scan around there. Anyone want to? Upstairs? No, I don't think so, is there? Shout out if you do, but don't. Okay, we'll try again in a moment. But yes, two hands there if we can get microphones round to them. Thank you.
Janine, you spoke about sending you and I a plane and really not knowing what was going to be on the other side. And you said even when you were in the hotel room and he was cloaking himself, you were sort of iffy on his legitimacy. So at what point did you realize this was something we were going to be talking about for a long time and was a big deal?
Shall I do the setup and you can do the reveal? So we had planned a whole load of things that, you know, in as much as you can, there's no guidebook on how to establish your NSA sort. And, you know, we were sort of talking and going, how do you know if this is a genuine FISA court order? Because nobody had ever seen such a thing. You can't sort of Google it and go, what do they look like? So we thought, okay, well, he must be end career because he's leaving the NSA with an enormous amount of access, and to have this level of access, he must be at the end of his career, so he must be sort of disenchanted. You know, we had a theory about how old he must be. We would honestly speculate about, I mean, is he sick? Is he feeling remorseful about what he's done? In none of our scenarios was he 29 and... As Stuart says, quite hot. That wasn't a thing we figured out. But we had a number, so we were saying, you know, has he got a car park pass? Has he got a verification? You know, show us some, what were the other things we came up with? I can't remember. But essentially it boiled down to, was the Guinness good, Ewan? It was, he had a code phrase, was the Guinness good.
The, Janine used to go out on the road with me during the election, and she'd get fed up with me taking her to Irish bars. So when, before I left New York, she said, look, we'll need some sort of code. And if Snowden's real, say the Guinness is good. And if,
in memory of all those crappy Irish people.
I don't think you can 100% be sure that someone's real. A lot of it's just instinct. He did show us, I said, how, prove who you are. And he threw open his suitcase and produced his social security number, his driving license, his CIA, a CIA ID, and a whole sheaf of documents, because he knew when he came to Hong Kong, he was going to have to prove who he was. And the documents seemed real. But I don't think we were sure. I mean, Alan and Janine and Stuart are going to be appalled by this, but I don't think we knew till we approached the White House and they said,
"Well, I think that's
no. We were the same. We didn't trust you that much."
But that's, you know, you don't stop at just asking the source. Well, you know, are you real? Yes or no? And you look at the documents. And I remember you saying, you know, nobody could produce that number and that variety of documents in a hoax. But the point where I think we sort of knew is when we went to we put this first story to Verizon. And we knew that if it was real, then they wouldn't be allowed to say anything. And if they come back and said, no, that's not right, then we should take them at their word. And we put the call in, and they said, OK, we'll call you right back. And about 3 seconds later, the phone rang again, and we picked up the phone. And they said, can you just give us the date on that order? Which one is it? Is it yellow or is it blue? OK, yeah, OK, we'll be back with you. And then they come back very quickly and said, we can't comment on that. And then there was the conversation with all the bobs where it was very obviously real. And at that point, you just know that it's real.
Because your question, basically what you're thinking, obviously the first question when you're sending is the source real? Absolutely. But even then, that's not going to be enough. It's, the source could be a real person and still have some mad vengeance or something. But in the end, all you're really coming down to is it true and is it in the public interest? So sitting back in the office in New York, not in the hotel room with all the excitement of soy sauce, you are just basically really focusing with what is your public interest case, what is your justification, what do you publish and what do you redact? And we had amazing help on that from lawyers, but in the end, just, some of the finest editorial brains from here who came out and real experts in the subject. And then, is it true? As Stuart said, you just narrow it down, and there are always clues. And the moment when the guy was going, which agency is it? And what are the dates?
But the other thing is, back on the point about, the British pressure, no sooner had we put the phone down on the bobs than we had a phone call from Paul Johnson, who's a deputy editor here in London, saying that MI5 had already been on the phone to London, saying that the New York office were in danger of getting The Guardian into a bit of trouble, and could we have a sort of think about what we were doing? And when those wheels start to turn, you just know it's going to
There's
be
also extreme. Another area, though, that you mentioned the Hitler Diaries earlier, Janine. Robert Harris, in his book on the Hitler Diaries, writes about the risk for journalists is that you want to believe it.
Right.
And there even comes a point where you need to believe it because you're thinking, you just want the story.
No,
I mean, you have to
really
be wary
aware
of that.
We're really, really aware of that. And, when you look at that, this was the first day we saw the material when Glenn brought it to the New York office. And our New York office is tiny, we're tiny little new subsidiary in a loft in Soho, and we're sitting on a sort of not very auspicious grey sofa in a tiny room, which, as I say, we didn't even have a speakerphone, and we're all huddled up reading this stuff on an air gap computer, which basically means a brand new computer that's never been on the internet that we'd sent somebody to go and buy for the least possible amount of money in cash from Best Buy. So this is this is not the Starship Enterprise. This is the opposite of that. And we're sitting there and looking at it. And if you've seen those slides, even the PowerPoint looks like it's been created by a not very adept 8-year-old. It's the sort of thing I would do. Oh, there's a triangle, and that represents the internet. And, and you're sort of looking at going, well, I mean, it does appear to represent total domination of the internet, but not very sophisticatedly. So there's not, it could all the time. So you are very, very aware right from the top that this is not,
you mustn't
will it into being.
You don't send Ewan if your aim is to believe the story. You
right,
send him,
you send Ewan if you really want to lose
yeah.
it.
Exactly, yeah.
Ewan is the very definition of not impressed.
And Alan, in thrillers such as State of Play, there's always a moment after the newspaper conference where one of the staff goes out and goes to the government or to the security services. Unlikely, probably, at The Guardian, but did you have to worry? I mean, was everyone on side, always?
About our own guy?
Yeah.
Well, when the cabinet secretary came into this building... I don't know if he was trying to spook us, but he wandered over to my window. My window looks out over the canal, and he looked at the housing over the road. There's a block of flats there, and he said, the Chinese will be in one of those flats. And then he said, and our guys will be in that flat over there. And then when the GCHQ guys came in, they said, why have you got a plastic cup on your table? I said, well, why shouldn't I have a plastic cup on my table? And they said, because the Russians will be over there, and they will. Don't you know about how you can train a laser on a plastic cup and turn it into a microphone? Because a plastic cup vibrates more than a glass cup.
Oh, yeah.
And then the cabinet secretary said, you will have Chinese spies certainly on the Guardian books. Well, if we have, we haven't discovered them yet, unless Ewan wants to make up. So I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, we had
We ended up working in a room here with security guards 24 hours outside. Nobody could get into the room without passing the security guards. Beyond the security guards, we had another member of staff before you could get into the room. So I think it would have been pretty hard, and there was always somebody in the room. It would have been pretty hard for a Chinese spy to have nicked in unnoticed.
Yeah, and in the New York office, you know, at the start of it, there was Janine and me who knew about it, and then Ewan was put on a plane. And then this was, you know, bear in mind, as Janine said, this is a tiny office with quite a young staff, and everybody knew something was going on, but there was, you know, it was kept very tight, and then these people parachuted in from London, and still nobody even thought to ask a question about it because they knew it was off limits.
There was a very patient person here who was waiting for... Yes, can we get the microphone around there? And then anyone further back? Yeah, there's somebody at the very back, if we could get the other microphone there, and then we'll go to the far corner. Yeah.
Thank you. I find it very surprising that, you know, actually don't find it surprising that the government kind of retreated, but at the same time, do you see some people in government, maybe in parliament, who actually are supportive of this cause, to have more privacy, to ultimately change this policy? And what do you see as crucial for mass surveillance to actually change, maybe in 5 or 10 years' time? I mean, what is the crucial point to maybe tilt the public opinion, or is it somebody who is in position of power and finally getting it that this is not the right way to do things?
I'd come to the conclusion that politicians find this subject almost impossible to talk about rationally. And you can completely understand that. But you talk to senior people on the Labour side, and they are just paranoid about being seen to be weak on security. So there are very few people on the Labour side who have said anything at all about this. They sometimes say things about oversight, but not much, actually. The Lib Dems were in government, and most politicians just don't want to touch it. It's too risky and toxic. So this balancing act that we give them and ask them to make this balancing act on our behalf is not really being done by politics. I think the ISC is not a sophisticated oversight body. I think the technology is not understood by most politicians. And so I think we have a real problem that what Snowden has done is to raise an enormous spread of... There's not one public interest here. There are numerous public interests which he's laid out in front of us. And I really struggle to see how politics is going to get to grips with this on our behalf, which raises the question, obviously, of who outside politics can help in this. But politics, I mean, I think it's particularly true in this country. I think German politics has coped with it better in the sense of aerating it and American politics too. But I think that's one of the big issues that we have to somehow negotiate after the next parliament, because they will be back. I mean, I thought the way, as Ewan said, you know, all the cases, Boston, Sydney, Copenhagen, London, Paris, all these were about people who were already on the radar. But within hours of Paris happening, David Cameron was coming out and saying we need the Snoopers Charter back in order to look at everybody. And so they are just, you can just see this, it's going to be wave after wave of attempts to get this through on the back of terrorist outrages, because that is going to be the heightened atmosphere which will be more conducive to the arguments, and it's difficult to see where the civil liberties arguments are going to come from. Certainly not in mainstream politics.
I think even in the US, where there was a much more vociferous debate, and where Congress did there's the Fourth Amendment, which is against illegal search and seizure, and there was people on the Senate Intelligence Committee like Ron Wyden, who for years have been trying to sort of signal that this stuff was going on, but couldn't say it in public because of their position. And even though there was a bunch of senators and people in the House bought bills, even though eventually Obama came out and said, yes, we should end bulk collection of phone metadata, the sort of complex of the NSA, CIA intelligence community machine is so powerful and is so ingrained in American political culture that absolutely nothing has changed, even though a lot of Congress and the President has said it should change. Just last week, they reauthorized bulk surveillance for the fifth time running since we published the first story. So,
I think there's one thing that might change the culture in the US. You know, Rand Paul was, you know, because it's a multi-party issue in the US, and the only people that would really come out publicly for bulk surveillance were really right in the heart of the administration. And on either end of either party, there was a lot of voices against. Rand Paul, who was one of the largest and most outspoken people against it, has started mentioning it as part of his campaign stand for Republican nomination. So, you know, I'm looking forward to endorsing him.
Just one small point. I mean, it's not all gloom, apart from Rand Paul. I think as a result of Snowden and the debate, you know, people are more conscious of surveillance than they once were. But the big change is in the big internet providers like Google and others. Yeah. Because there's been such a consumer backlash against them, they're now automatically introducing encryption, you know, just as, you know, a norm. And the way you've seen the intelligence services in both America and the UK, every time head of MI5 or MI6 or GCHQ makes a speech, they say, Google and other companies have got to give us access to encryption. So it's hurting them. And to me, that's one of the best things that can happen if it becomes normal that people use encryption.
You asked what would change it. Consumer behavior will change it. Google got frightened when they thought their customers would walk with their feet. That was what changed.
If it's worked out, there should be microphones in both back corners. So, yeah, if we start there, please.
I'm sorry, it's kind of the same question I was going to ask. What your views are on how surveillance should be regulated, but maybe to rephrase it, should the online world be treated like the offline world insofar as you can only start surveilling people if you have a good reason to, and if you know you acquire a warrant, and is it analogous in that sense, or is there something very different about the online world that means the rules have to be different?
I actually think, you know, that's not just a matter of sort of civil liberties and privacy. I think it's a matter of the intelligence community being effective, because the euphemism that keeps getting used is they've got a giant haystack, and all they keep doing is that making the haystack bigger, and nobody's looking for the needle, and that's why they keep missing them. So I think what they should be doing is being more targeted. They should have better surveillance on people they know that there's reasonable cause to be concerned about, and they should spend less time just scooping up vast quantities of, you know, communications records just on the off chance they're going to spot something in there.
And then in the other corner, there should be someone there. Yeah.
Yes. It's the same sort of subject. But back in the 1980s, Philip Knightley, the Australian journalist, wrote a very good book called The Second Oldest Profession, in which he analysed the incompetence and inefficiency and the disasters of the various intelligence services throughout the world. And the answer the intelligence services always produce from all over the world, whether it's the KGB or MI5, MI6 or the CIA, is always, give us more resources and we will find the right answer. We won't mess up again. Which is exactly what has happened since the 1980s, way, way back, long before all this technology existed, long before the world of Snowden could have existed, they were increasing the budgets throughout the so-called democratic world. And that has continued to happen, I think, massively now. And isn't it a question of trying to limit the budgets of these people before they get out of control, rather like Macbeth's witches?
Just for an answer, could you get the microphone to the very back corner? Sure. There's someone who's been waiting a long time. Thanks, Alan.
I'm not sure. I don't know about the budgets, but I'm not. I'm in favour of giving them the resources they need. So when you hear that in all these cases recently, they actually knew the people, they were on the radar, they'd sometimes spoken to them,
but they were incapable of following them. So these were the needles. They had them, but even when they had them, they couldn't do it. So that may be an argument for more resources. I just think the argument for the haystack is the one that has to be made. And the question about the online versus the offline world, I think, is a really interesting one, because offline, none of us would tolerate a world in which the police could come in without a warrant and get the kind of information that they're getting. We would regard that as an absolutely fundamental infringement of hundreds of years of law. And yet, somehow, we all agree to it. And somehow, I think most of us just find this terribly hard to understand. There have been two stories recently about the hardware. So the fact that weaknesses or backdoors were put in the computers themselves, or in SIM cards. The SIM cards have been broken. Well, you know, who in the audience, given the choice between a computer that had been compromised by the state or a phone that had been compromised by the state, you can buy this computer, which is going to send a copy of everything you do to the government for storage, or you can buy the one that isn't. Who's going to buy the one that is compromised? So we can sort of understand it in hardware terms, but somehow once it's up there in the cloud, it seems, or being siphoned through pipes that go through Cornwall, we find this very difficult to get a hold of. But so I think this question about the resources, maybe they need more resources, but it ought to be that, first of all, they have to convince us why they need the bigger the haystack, when all the evidence recently is they can't actually act on the needles.
But on that, though, because certainly a lot of people in politics say, and some people on other newspapers, that if they brought in kind of terrorist sus laws in which all these people on the radar were simply locked up, or that newspapers led by The Guardian would be saying what an outrage that was, and that is a problem.
Well, I try to think of it more from the perspective of the person living their life, who is subject every day to dragnet collection and a sort of level of assessment and what they know about you. And I do think the offline parallel is really important. If you knew that somebody was just going to have a wander into your house, have a good rifle through your photo albums, check your diary and your contacts book, and just see what you've been doing for the last few days, and have a good speculate about what you might have been doing with those people, and that within three hops, they call it, but you know, three branches of relation between everybody you know, that they could then, if there was somebody that looked a bit ropey, then literally everything you do is subject to poring over and question mark. I think people would feel completely differently about it. But I think because it's called metadata, there's a sense that some benign person in Gloucestershire is sort of looking at it and vaguely going, oh, they seem nice, we won't bother with them. And that's just not the reality of it. I think we would be absolutely outraged at the idea that we should all leave our front doors open and any member of the, anybody who's just on their first training day at GCHQ can have a good rifle round.
And all the resources arguments that they make are all about more powers, more money to do more bulk surveillance. But at the same time, as they say, well, we can't possibly watch all these people because it takes, 30 to 50 people to have round-the-clock surveillance on somebody, and we just can't afford that. So this is the kind of, you know, cheap option. And, the truth is that is the much more effective option, and it would have stopped, or at least given them a better chance of stopping, almost all the plots that have happened recently.
The fact is, it's not for us to decide what is the right level, clearly, and I think we resisted trying to do that the whole time we were doing the story, because all our job was to do was go, this is being done in your name to you, and you need to know that.
We're moving towards the end of this. If we take the one at the back, and then we can probably very quickly take those couple in the middle. Yeah.
Thank you. What's fascinating is that the quantity of data sort of bypasses the traditional argument that you might expect to hear, which is, you know, we couldn't possibly tell you why it is that we need to surveil these people, because that's actually a matter of national security. So that's almost sort of put away half of the debate that I suppose lots of people are interested in. I myself am very interested in that. But I was wondering, you know, we've also not heard any sense of conspiracy or a whiff of it. And I wanted to ask, you know, with the 60,000 documents that Ewan was given, I mean, have you gone through those? Have you got the desire to go through those? And do you suspect that there is an ulterior motive being billed as, well, we just couldn't possibly pay people to do this unless we just gathered everything on everybody? When you link your Oyster card to your credit card, has there been a whiff of that? That's what I'm interested in.
Right at the outset, Snowden said, Snowden is a patriot. I know a lot of Americans would find that hard to believe.
Including the president.
Including the president. So when he came, he didn't want, he said to us and he said to Alan that he only wanted published documents that had a constitutional element to them about this broad debate about privacy and surveillance. He didn't want documents published that dealt with operational matters, the sort of nitty-gritty day-to-day targeting of suspected terrorists in Pakistan or Iraq and people listening in Afghanistan. So there are a lot of documents as a journalist, as a reporter, I would have quite liked to have done. But Snowden and Alan laid down this dictum that we would not report operational matters.
Because Assange had been accused of putting people's lives at risk, hadn't he?
Yep.
But, yeah.
I've never met Assange, and I've got no beef with him, and I'm grateful to him for bringing WikiLeaks to The Guardian. So I try to resist comparisons with Assange, but it is one of the major differences. Assange put the whole WikiLeaks cache out into the public, and Snowden has totally resisted that.
The lady there, we're not going to get them. We'll try as many as we can. And I think, somebody in front wanted? Yes, you start, and then we'll see where we go.
Right. Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much for showing the movie. First of all, does anyone know how you get a job with one of those surveillance companies? Because I think I could actually do with some surveying of my own, like, few numbers and stuff. Some joke aside, actually, my question is, if you are planning to do something that is not right, would you not encrypt your messages? Would you not actually do everything to hide yourself? I mean, you know, I send everything through openly, but probably so does everybody in this room, hopefully. But if you are hiding things, you know, if you have something to hide, you know, you wouldn't do it openly. So the whole purpose of this surveillance, and I believe the cost of actually containing all this information and keeping it somewhere every single day, I mean, billions and billions of information, I cannot imagine the cost.
On that point, if you are trying to do something nefarious, then you're not going to be caught in a general trawl anyway.
Can I just suggest that Ewan doesn't give out a handbook on how to commit crimes? Hi, Ewan.
Osama bin Laden, you know, the reason why he was able to hide for so long is because he didn't use emails, it was letter drops, it was couriers. The idea that the terrorists, the bad guys, only found out that the intelligence agencies might be looking at their emails when Snowden came out is just sort of laughable. But it is the argument that the intelligence agencies have run here and on Capitol Hill. It's just completely ridiculous. But the thing to remember about encryption as well is it's not just people who are trying to hide what they do. It's bank transactions, it's medical records, it's everything about your online life. But in intelligence terms, everything that's encrypted is per se suspicious. And that is the wrong end of the telescope, absolutely.
And these are going to have to be the last two, but I think if we take gentleman there and then over there. Yeah.
Thank you. Is Snowden a hero?
Is Snowden a hero? Barack Obama says no, he's not, but journalists aren't supposed to have heroes, are they, Ewan, really?
Someone said, you know, the last 18 months have been good for us. We've been awarded the Pulitzer Prize, you know, the first non-American publication ever to receive that. And Janine got an Emmy, and
we all got an Emmy.
We've all got an Emmy. And we've received countless other awards. Laura got an Oscar last week for Citizen Four. Glenn's written his book. And Snowden is in Russia. Although his life isn't that bad, I mean, it's better than being in life imprisonment in a supermax prison in Colorado. It's not what he would have chosen. He'd much rather be in Western Europe, and he'd much rather be in America. So Snowden is the one that paid the huge price for this. And he did it. He had a nice life. He was well paid, living in Hawaii. Prospects for promotion pretty good. And he gave it up because of a principle. He just felt that we're walking into a world, living in a world where the balance between privacy and surveillance has shifted too far, and that someone needed to bring it to public attention. So for me, there's no doubt he's anything other than a hero.
And when you meet Billy Richardson on set on the Oliver Stone, you can say, I've got an Emmy, because I don't think she has, actually.
I don't know.
Anyway, there you are.
Thanks.
Yes, over there. Sorry?
Where to from here for everybody?
We will keep reporting the documents. We will keep reporting the fallout from the documents. We're not going to leave this story alone. So I think that's stand by for more.
And gentlemen, yeah.
I hope this is not too much of a general question to end on. Where I come from, Canada, our government is currently pushing through increased surveillance powers for the spy agencies. And anybody who has actually cared to read about it has found it quite disquieting. Numerous lawyers, former prime ministers, so forth. But the problem is most people have not cared to inform themselves about it, despite the information so freely available. And as it ties into this story, this was obviously such a massive story when it broke, but I think it has faded from a lot of the national discourses. And so my question is, is there more that you think journalists could do to drive public engagement? And perhaps more importantly, what can the public do to help drive that engagement with these issues that do not seem to be getting the attention that many feel they deserve?
Well, I mean, we've touched on some of the things. You know, use technology that encrypts your communications. I know there's been a 80% take up in use of the Tor browser. It's a small base, but that's a sort of significant thing. You know, you have the ability to talk to your representatives and say, I don't feel happy about this. Most politicians won't come out and talk about it, but you have the ability to force them to talk about it. And when the politicians come in here, we force them to talk about it. So there's about to be a general election campaign in the UK. You know, we have the ability to force them to talk about it. And people in Canada, I would hope, are similarly sort of very confused about this. Canadians seem quite right-minded. They should feel quite confused and conflicted.
I think the biggest blunder that's happened in recent months, and there's been such complacency about this in this country. The most extraordinary sentence that sprung out was a piece that Max Hastings wrote in the Daily Mail recently. And I love Max, but on this issue, he is very, very hostile to Snowden. And he wrote this sentence that said, I cannot imagine why all of us, all our citizens, shouldn't surrender and be completely happy to have the government reading all our emails and all our phone calls. And you think, really, Max? You've written histories of the Second World War, of Nazi Germany. You cannot imagine how this could... how this could be put to malign uses. But that complacency has been punctured because the police did this incredibly stupid thing, which was to
use the Ripper legislation to get the telephone sources and the contacts and the sources of journalists on the Mail on Sunday and the Sun. And I think that behaviour by the police has woken up British journalists who are being incredibly complacent, because if it's done to journalists, they feel it very personally, as they should. And you realise that actually the Home Office has now come out and said, we will not recognise journalistic privilege, we won't recognise legal privilege, we won't recognise the relationship of confidentiality between a doctor and a patient, or a priest and a communicant, or even an MP and a constituent. So that's some pen pusher in the Home Office put this out saying, we in future will not recognise these customs and privileges and promises that we have granted people, because we now want to be able to surveil them without any say-so of a judge. And I think the penny is beginning to drop of the awesome powers that the state is taking upon themselves. And that's the thing that gives me hope.
Good night, Tanner. The thing we're going to just very briefly from you, and a trailer for the Oliver Stone movie. It is rumoured that the Oliver Stone movie includes an astonishing amount of sex. There's a scene where Tom Wilkinson says, "I may be a Scottish Presbyterian, but..." No, but apparently there is quite a lot of sex in it. But it's not your character.
It's not me, no.
Well, you have to go and watch it to find out who does have all the sex in that film. But it's the answer to the question, what does he do in Moscow all day? That is the answer. Anyway, thank you very much to Alan Rusbridger, Janine Gibson, Ewan McCaskill, and Stuart Miller, and to all of you. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.